And we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Here she comes. I'm down the hall, around the corner. She's into the final stretch.
I'm here. I just have to sit down.
Yes, please sit down. Sit down. All right. So,
hey, you over there, you're not in the tea party. Sit down.
Let's start things out with local and Rob McKenna.
Yeah, speaking of people who shouldn't be in the tea party.
Or shouldn't, at least shouldn't be drinking the tea.
Yeah, or whatever it is that he's drinking. Yeah, Attorney General Rob McKenna announced immediately after the passage of the health care reform bill this week that he would be joining about 10 other Republican state attorneys general in a lawsuit to try and prevent the federal government from enforcing its mandate for individual coverage. And there's some problems with this, such as that six of Washington's nine congressional, or actually eight of 11 congressional representatives, including the two senators, voted in favor of it. The state electorate also voted in favor of Obama, and it did so, and did in favor of the senators who voted for it by wide margins. I think Obama won the state with 58% of the vote. So the question is, who is Rob McKenna actually representing here? Well, he's not representing the law, because most legal experts agree that the lawsuit has not that much chance of being successful politically. He's basically, this is basically a political stunt, and it's being done, for really fairly unclear reasons, because McKenna has won statewide office primarily by convincing independent voters that he's not like those radical Republicans, that he's the reasonable guy, sort of the Sam Reed model of being a moderate Republican who doesn't rock the boat and who doesn't sort of salute every time the Republicans run something crazy up the flagpole. That's not actually an accurate reflection of McKenna's politics. In point of fact, he's always been heavily supported by the BIAW and various other right-wing business interests, and has done their bidding pretty consistently. But this is really his coming out party for that, and it really angered a lot of people.
Yeah, what I think is interesting about this is I kind of view it as McKenna's sort of auditioning to run for another office, and I'm thinking he's probably getting ready to run for governor.
Yeah, that's widely expected that he'll run for governor in 2012.
Yeah,
but the only way this makes sense in that context is if he's trying to shore up his base.
Yeah,
if he's worried about a primary challenge on the Republican side.
Yeah, I think so. But one of the things that I find very interesting is that Republicans are coming out to try to stop this bill by bringing this lawsuit. I find it interesting because the whole healthcare reform bill has been framed to support Republican priorities in terms of healthcare reform. It is the biggest giveaway to a private industry I think I've seen in a long time. It's going to really be a boost for the health insurance industry.
There's a lot of competition for that giveaway title.
There is, including the all of the spending on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, largely a giveaway to defense contractors.
Medicare Part B, the Telecommunications Act.
Yes, but
let's not forget the bailouts.
Yes, but this is going to make Medicare Part B look like a tiny handout. But what's interesting is that the lawsuit is framed, and McKenna described it as being unconstitutional because it would force Americans to buy a private product, and that is unprecedented. But he didn't say that the whole reason it's framed to buy private insurance is because the Republicans insisted on that it be a private insurance deal, and that there be no government option in the plan. So really, it's sort of like the Republicans saying, well, thank you for passing a bill that's framed the way we want it. Now we're going to sue you because you did it that way.
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, the history of the framing for the health care bill is a conservative framing. It was basically originally a plan that was put forward by the Heritage Foundation in the early 90s in response to Bill Clinton's health care proposal at that time. And that was the basis for Mitt Romney, also, last we checked, a Republican, passing a very similar measure in Massachusetts 3 or 4 years ago. So it's basically a Republican framework. The other thing that's interesting about this is McKenna himself, you know, it's like the hypocrisy of these people sometimes just knows no bounds. He's making the argument, and it's basically a Tea Party, 10th Amendment movement type argument that the federal government doesn't have the right to impose these kind of restrictions on the states. It's the whole 10th Amendment of the Constitution. You know, the powers that aren't vested in the federal government by the Constitution are abrogated to the states. But, you know, every federal court has thrown this out over the years. There's really no basis to it. But more importantly, McKenna has used the exact opposite argument when it comes to why he has continued to harass patients under the state's medical marijuana law when it runs into conflicts with the federal law there. In that case, he's arguing that the federal law takes precedent and the states don't have any right to challenge it. So he's arguing one side of the issue on one and one side of, and the other side of the issue on the other, and it's entirely political. And the fact that he's using taxpayer dollars to pursue this lawsuit is just appalling. There have been a number of responses to this, by the way. There was a Facebook page where people were signing on to opt out of the lawsuit that had something like 14,000 Facebook fans in the first 24 hours. And there's another PAC that's been sent up, which I believe is norob.org, which is something like no refusing our benefits or something like that. And that's raised quite a bit of money also. So there's been a lot of response to this. But I think actually it's a very poor political move on McKenna's part if he's doing it in order to set himself up for a future political race, because it entirely stripped away this idea that McKenna is this conscience-driven independent that isn't crassly partisan in the way of a lot of other Republicans.
Which would be the best that anyone could expect from the Republican Party these days. Yeah, he's a guy that everybody has pointed to as he's old-style Republican. He's, you know, he's reasonable, he's intelligent. Well, this proves that he's not immune to the worst of the extreme right within the Republican Party.
Okay, moving on briefly. Governor Gregoire signing a bill for cell phones.
Yeah, she signed into law this week a bill that was passed by the legislature that will ban the use of handheld cell phones, either holding it to your ear or texting while driving. It'll make it a primary offense, and that goes into law starting June 10th. So, distracted drivers, you better turn off your cell phone when you get in the car.
All right. And Dino Rossi testing the waters this week?
Yeah, he was back in D.C. meeting with the National Republican Senatorial Committee folks about their possibly helping to fund a run for him against Patty Murray this fall. The Republicans have been casting around pretty desperately for somebody notable in the Republican Party to run against Murray, because right now the Republicans don't really have any figures with any kind of statewide name ID that can run against her. And their first choice to run against her was Dave Reichert, who somewhat surprisingly, and this predates his health problems this week, decided that he didn't want to run against Murray. That's actually a fairly sensible decision, given that the last three times Murray has run, it's in each case been against a standing Republican member of Congress, Nethercutt and so forth. And she's retired each and every one of them. So, yeah, it's probably a good move in terms of job security on Reichert's part. But the interesting thing about Rossi is this comes in the wake of a number of unflattering revelations regarding him, regarding some of his financial dealings with people in the real estate industry, and in particular, a gentleman who turns out to be Puget Sound's own little answer to Bernie Madoff in terms of bilking investors of over $100 million, a former business associate of Rossi's who Rossi was associated with long after he turned out to come to the attention of prosecutors as somebody who was dealing dishonestly. So if Rossi does run for office, that's sure to become an issue this time in a way that it didn't during the 2008 gubernatorial race. And that may wind up keeping him out of the race.
All right. Moving on to national and healthcare bill passing this week.
Yeah, I was pretty appalled to see some of the anger by right-wing activists in response to the passage of the healthcare reform bill. It was very interesting because, you know, I know we've talked on this program before about how folks like Sarah Palin like to stir up right-wing activists and incite them to violence. This time around, the violence erupted, and there was vandalism, death threats, one senator or one representative who was trying to run the gauntlet of activists outside Congress to get inside in order to vote on the bill was spat upon. There were racial slurs thrown around. People were subject to homophobic slurs as well. It was just an example of...
A brother of one of the Congress people had the gas line to his house cut because a blogger gave out the address that he thought he was mistaken. And this gives you an idea of the IQ of some of these people. He thought he was giving out the congressman's home address. And the brother, who has, you know, several young children in the house, very easily could have blown up the house.
Yeah, yeah.
That's terrorism, by the way.
Yeah, that's what you might consider to be domestic terrorism. And when asked to disavow the violence by Democrats, Republicans stood up and they kind of said, well, you know, people are angry. This is what John Bonner said. He said, people are angry and you know, we shouldn't be surprised at their anger, blah, 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 blah. And then towards the end of his statement,
since he said, helped to stir it up.
Yeah. And towards the end of his statement, he said, however, we can't condone violence. You know, people need to find more constructive ways to use or positive ways to use their anger.
Oh, yeah. I have down here in my notes that I'm supposed to say that.
Yeah. Yeah. And which is not sufficient. I mean, that's not. That doesn't cut it when you're asked to tone it down to say, gosh, you know, people are angry and I support that, and then towards the end say, oh, by the way, it's not legal to attack people. That's not sufficient. And you know, and then to have Sarah Palin stand up and tell her supporters, oh, don't feel bad that the healthcare reform bill passed. You should go home and reload. That not only doesn't cut it, that to me that says she knows what she's doing when she's inciting people to violence, and that she enjoys it and thinks it's a good thing. And to a certain extent, I feel like I'm living in 1930s Germany, and that Sarah Palin is auditioning to be the leader of the American Nazi Party. That's what I really feel like when I see this kind of thing.
Yeah, there's good news and the bad news. The good news is that people who aren't already drinking the Tea Party Kool-Aid, a mixed metaphor intentional there, you know, are repulsed by this. The public opinion polls show that actually the support for the healthcare bill has risen this past week, and that people are really pretty appalled by the violent reaction on the right. The bad news is that if you're not committed to democracy and you're not committed to the democratic process where a majority of elected representatives pass a bill, and that the people who don't pass the bill go back and reload for next time, you know, if you're not committed to the idea of the democratic process, you don't need a majority. You know, you can intimidate people into doing your bidding without actually representing a majority of the country. And that's the road this is headed down. And it's very, very frightening.
Yeah. We don't always understand in an old democracy like ours, we don't always understand that there's a thin line between civil discourse and civil war. You can see that in countries where the democracy is newer or more fragile, places like Iraq, for example, where violence can erupt very easily. But it can happen here as well, and it doesn't take much. It only takes people who are very angry and people with some power and some access to the media to stir them up.
And people who don't feel like the opposition is legitimate, like, you know, they're socialists and communists.
Yeah, yeah.
Or born in Kenya.
And what the Republicans are tapping into without really fully understanding, or in the case of Sarah Palin, who I used to think doesn't understand, but now I think she really does understand and really has a sort of psychotic enjoyment out of all of this, what those people are tapping into is a broader anger. And the anger is legitimate. The anger that people feel over the economy, the way the economy has collapsed, and over joblessness. There are a lot of people who are unemployed right now and really struggling to pay the bills. people who are angry because the wars are dragging on and there doesn't seem to be any solid achievement after nearly a decade of war. And people who have seen their savings decrease and their mortgages go up and are having trouble making ends meet, that's a legitimate anger. Unfortunately, those people
and see that the powers that be favoring corporate America and not helping them.
Right, and they're not seeing any resolution to their problems, and they're not seeing that the government can or is able to help them out. And of course, our media doesn't have an institutional memory, so it can't help people see that there are bigger historical forces at work, that the recession is not something that has just started in the last year or two. It's something that's been going on for at least a decade, and that the housing market bubble and the relaxed credit that has gotten everybody into trouble, it was just sort of something that put off the results of this long-term recession for a few years during the Bush administration, and it has actually made things worse. So people don't really understand, they don't get the long view, and they don't really understand what's going on, and that the current government can't just put the brakes on the recession and turn things around. They can't just flick a switch and change something that is historically a part of our system. You know, and so they respond with anger, and they're easily riled up by these folks in the Republican Party who want to try to channel that anger into the midterm elections to try to get them back into power in Congress.
All right. Let's move on. Bank of America and Wells Fargo. What is up with them?
Well, speaking of a political system that helps out the big guys but not the little guys, turns out that Bank of America and Wells Fargo aren't going to pay any taxes for the year 2009. Bank of America, because it quote unquote lost money after it took in gobs and gobs and gobs of federal bailout money and turned around and used that money not to loan money to people, to small businesses and individuals who were distressed and needed it, but to buy some of their competitors, and particularly buy competitors that were in financial difficulty themselves so that they could get their assets at reduced rates. Wells Fargo won't owe any money because it bought Wachovia, and Wachovia had losses for 2009. So we see once again that while people who themselves were unemployed or had mortgage foreclosures or were otherwise in financial difficulty in 2009, they'll still have to pay taxes, but the big corporations, not so much.
Yeah, one of the really bad things about folks who are having to do like short sales, for example, where you sell your house for less than you owe on the mortgage, is that when a part of your debt is forgiven, you owe tax on that money. And so there are a lot of people who are going through bankruptcy or near bankruptcy who are managing short sales on their home, meaning that they're going to have to rent or be kicked out of their homes, and who are seeing their credit destroyed are going to owe a lot of tax because of the deals that they have to work out in order to try to salvage their economic situation. Those folks are going to look at this and go, what in the heck is the matter with the government, with the system, with the world, when big companies like Bank of America and Wells Fargo don't owe any tax, but here I am, I had a really horrible year, I lost my home, et cetera, and I still have to pay money to the IRS.
And speaking of a loss of historical memory and people who don't understand, what the responsibility is for some of these things, a lot of the reasons that some of these companies don't need to pay taxes now are due to changes in the tax law that were made during the Bush administration.
Yes.
Not that they weren't signed off on by Democrats as well, but that's when they happened, and those have not been revisited the way they need to be.
Yeah, it's a problem with the system. It's not a problem with Republicans, Democrats, one president or another. It's the way the system works.
All right. Moving on, Pentagon making an announcement this week that didn't get much press play.
Yeah, don't ask, don't tell, which a lot of people have been pressuring Barack Obama to abolish entirely. Well, he has not done that, but the Pentagon has announced that it will no longer investigate individual soldiers for violations of the don't ask, don't tell policy. In other words, it won't investigate rumors by third parties that, soldier Jane or John Doe happens to be gay. They will still have to take action, of course, because Don't Ask, Don't Tell is still on the books if Jane or John comes out and says, hey, commanding officer, over here, I'm gay. But if, for instance, you know, somebody else in a unit just says, you know, I think Jane is gay and you should really look at her, they won't go and investigate that soldier's private life. So that's very much a step forward. Unfortunately, the Pentagon review that has been ordered by the Obama administration on the logistics of abolishing Don't Ask, Don't Tell entirely is not due until December 1. So it's going to be on the books still for another year at least. And, you know, when all it really should take is an executive order. The best way to abolish it is to, well, you know, abolish it.
All right. Moving on to international and starting with Iraq.
Yeah. We got the results from the elections in Iraq this week, and Ayad Alawi, who is a Shiite but has cobbled together a coalition of a non-sectarian coalition that includes a lot of the Sunni politicians who were not able to run during the elections, he has come out with a slight majority in the elections, 91 seats versus 89 seats by Nouri al-Maliki's coalition. And so his party's been declared the winner. However, he needs 163 seats in parliament in order to form a government. So he's going to have to sit down with some of the other groups to try to form a government. That's going to be hard since the Kurds are not likely supporters of his coalition, and Muqtada al-Sadr, the other party that got a number of seats in the election, they're not supporters of the secular party that's run by Ayad Alawi. So it's looking like he's going to have trouble forming a coalition government. He has until July to do that. In the meantime, Nouri al-Maliki, who doesn't have a majority, didn't win a majority in the election, is going to be the lame duck prime minister until that time. And if Ayad Alawi fails in forming a government, then Maliki will get his chance to try. And he's going to have difficulty, too, especially since his government banned a number of Sunni politicians from running. He's going to not be able to pull Ayad Alawi's group into his coalition. So he's going to have to try to make friends with Muqtada al-Sadr after having demonized him.
Yeah, both of them are pretty unpopular in a wide swath of Iraqi society. And a lot of that has to do with the fact still that both of them are exiles that were brought in by the Bush administration to help run Iraq in the early days of the occupation. And here they still are, you know, 6 years later, dominating Iraqi politics, which tells you a lot about the quality of the American imposed democracy that Iraq is trying to struggle with.
Yep.
All right. And briefly, Pakistan.
Yeah, this week a Pakistani delegation was in Washington, D.C. to try to cut a deal for aid and for aid money and for military aid for Pakistan. And it was really emblematic of where the Pakistani government is going, because Hillary Clinton was supposed to be meeting with the Pakistani foreign minister. She spent some time with him, but she spent most of her quality time with General Ashfaq Kayani, who is the real person in charge of the Pakistani government these days. It is turning out to become a military regime, with parliament now stripping most of the powers from the elected president of Pakistan. They're currently in negotiations to take away most of his power and turn it over to the prime minister, who is very closely aligned with the generals who now pretty much run the Pakistani government.
All right.
So the days of General Musharraf running Pakistan are returning to Pakistan with U.S. influence now.
All right. Briefly, Israel.
Yeah. Speaking of meetings in D.C. this week, Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, was at the White House this week. And there's been a lot of attention recently about diplomatic tension between Israel and the United States, particularly between the Netanyahu administration and the Obama administration. Well, Obama walked out on his meeting with Netanyahu this week when Netanyahu refused to offer a written guarantee that the Israeli government would put a moratorium on illegal building in East Jerusalem. Now, you know, This being said, and it's good that Obama is taking this position, but it hasn't actually translated into actual policy changes by the United States vis-a-vis foreign policy with Israel. Where it might have some influence is because relationships are so tense between the U.S. and Israel right now. Israel might be a little less likely to launch a preemptive strike against Iran, but in terms of U.S. support for new settlements or building in East Jerusalem or trying to restart the peace process that Mahmoud Abbas is trying to restart right now. There's verbal prodding by the Obama administration, but nothing real substantive in terms of policy changes to back it up yet.
All right. And finally, briefly, Russia.
Yeah, we had a good news this week, a nuclear disarmament treaty to replace START II, which the START treaty expired in December with Russia. The negotiations have been dragging on for months, and they finally reached a tentative agreement this week. That agreement will still have to be ratified by Congress, which is going to be a real struggle. And there are a number of other things that are key this year with the nuclear disarmament efforts. Where the kind of progress that needs to be made might not necessarily be made. There's going to be a major session on disarmament with the United Nations coming up in May. The nuclear posture review, which the Pentagon does every 4 years with a new administration, is due out and is reflective of a real schism between Secretary Gates, who wants a new generation of nuclear weapons, and the Obama administration, which is rhetorically committed to long-term disarmament and eventually abolition of nuclear weapons. And it looks like the nuclear posture review is not going to posit any major changes in U.S. policy in terms of moving away from first strike capacity and trying to build a new generation of weapons. So while the treaty with Russia is good, the larger issue of global disarmament is still very problematic. And of course, speaking of Israel, one of the key things to that, and one of the key things in the Iran situation, is that until Israel is made to acknowledge and comply with international norms on its nuclear arsenal, you're still going to have an awful lot of problems with convincing other players in that part of the world to disarm as well.
All right, and events.
Several events coming up in the next week. Tonight at 6:30, Food Sovereignty, Agricultural Development, and the Gates Foundation with Kenyan farmer and activist Joshua Machinga and Community Alliance for Global Justice Director Heather Day, who's just back from Kenya. And
that should be a good one.
That should be a very good one. Unfortunately, I just realized that I didn't write down where it was. But if you Google the date and Heather Day or Joshua Machinga, M-A-C-H-I-N-G-A, you should be able to find it. My apologies for that. Tomorrow at 1:30, you heard Travis Bishop on the air here at 7:30 this morning. There will be a rally in support of him and GI resistors in general tomorrow at 1:30 at I-5 exit 122 near the Coffee Strong Coffee House. Also tomorrow at 1:30, Nuclear Weapons Free World Conference and Concert going on down in Tacoma at Urban Grace Church, 904 Market Street. On Monday evening at 7:30 at Town Hall, Erin Dottie Roy. Do not miss that one. She is amazing.
That's
if you've never seen her in person. Or even if you have seen her in person, she's still amazing. And then on Thursday, also at Town Hall, another very good forum, Making Democracy Work with Nancy Amade, Paul Loeb, and Jerry Large from the Seattle Times. It's a League of Women forum, League of Women's Voters forum. I can say this, really I can. That'll be held downstairs at Town Hall, 7:30 on Thursday.
All right. A good week for events.
Yes.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And quickly, where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks where you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, King County Library System. And we got some good news this week. This coming week was supposed to be our last regular print edition. And we got a last-minute infusion of cash, which will help us hopefully raise a little money to sustain it long-term. We'll talk about that more in coming weeks. But so we'll be coming out this week. It will be April Fool's Week. So, you know, just fair warning. You can also find us online at www.thestate.org. And for questions, comments, tips, if you have feedback on the show, anything like that, give us an email. Our email is info@thestate.org.